Coming up on Boston Public Radio, breaking news. Jim had an exclusive interview with a juror from the John O'Brien jaw-breaking trial who questions the claims of innocence of House Speaker Bob DeLeo. Then, Mark Fisher. He fought his way onto the GOP primary ballot against Charlie Baker. Fisher wanted in and wants those kids who came across the border to get out. He'll join us in studio. James Vrabel on his new book, tracing how Boston went from a seedy backwater into a soaring city. Open mic with the Globe's Alex Beam on John Le Carré, one of his favorite writers, and an I'm So Boston game that is really funny. Plus, is Brookline a snobby town or not? Finally, Karen Miller on how we can all get smarter, and it's got nothing to do with reading, writing, or those internet brain games. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hi.
So our intention today was to start the show with conversation of John Lester, the ace pitcher for the Red Sox, departure for the Oakland A's. But actually something I would argue much more important has interceded. We've talked a lot about the probation trial here, almost nonstop during the trial, during deliberations, post-verdict, as you know, the convictions of John O'Brien, former probation commissioner, and two of his lieutenants. One of the most dramatic pieces of the whole trial was the mention of the Speaker of the House as an unindicted co-conspirator by the prosecutors late in the trial, not in the opening statement. Not indicted, no opportunity on the part of Bob DeLeo, the Speaker of the House, to respond, which a lot of people think is quite unfair on the part of the U.S. Attorney, Carmen Ortiz. And Bob DeLeo, subsequent to the verdict, has said unequivocally, explicitly, he said it to me on television, he said it to anybody who asked, that he feels exonerated by the verdict of the jury because there was no bribery conviction, meaning that there were not two sides of a deal. He's used the word that I felt exonerated. Somebody else who's commented on this, which has been fairly high profile the last few days, is the mayor of Boston was kind enough to spend an hour with us the other day. And in the middle of the interview, we asked him this. Based on having served in the legislature and observing the trial, I know you weren't in the courtroom, I know you weren't in the jury, was John O'Brien guilty of a crime?
That's a good question. I don't think so.
And needless to say, if you've been reading the papers and listening to the talk around town, there's been a lot of discussion about what that means and whether that was a wise decision. We'll leave that to you. That's not what we're here to discuss today. Last night, I got an email from someone who identified themselves as a member of the probation trial jury. And after I spoke to Marjorie about it, you said something like, you better make sure that this actually was a member of the jury before you read any.
Yeah,
is that what you said?
You never know until you check it out. So, yes, you had to make sure it was a member of the jury. And indeed, I think you've confirmed it was a member of the jury.
We shared some of this information with the Boston Globe and through the work of the Boston Globe and the reporter who's been working on the case, Milton Valencia, and through some conversations I had with this juror, who we will not name, by the way, at this particular juror's request. We confirmed that this was a member of the jury in the John O'Brien probation verdict. So what we're going to do, it's going to take a minute or two because it's long and I think quite thoughtful. We're going to read you, Marjorie and I are going to read you, the actual email I received late last night from this member of the jury. And then we're going to urge you to give us a buzz at 877-301-8970 and get your sense of what your reaction is to this and what you think should happen next. And by the way, the reporters at WGBH are now reaching out to two people mentioned in this, the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh, and most specifically, Robert DeLeo, the Speaker of the House, who's got a pretty busy day since it's either the last day or the second to last day of session. So should we start?
Well, I think before we start, just so people don't get lost in the weeds, I think the two essential points here is that this juror takes issue with Mayor Walsh claiming that this was not a crime, that John O'Brien did not commit a crime. And the second thing, he takes issue with Speaker DeLeo saying that he was exonerated. In fact, the juror does not feel that DeLeo was exonerated at all. So those are the two main points. And now,
Right, you'll hear the juror in this person's own words. So, yes. Do you want to start?
I'll start. Okay, sure. This is the letter from the juror. As a member of the jury that delivered the verdict in the John O'Brien trial, I find the mayor's comments irresponsible and reckless and borderline ridiculous. He suggests we came to the wrong decision and then states that he, quote, didn't get all the facts of the case. So how would he know if we came to the wrong decision or not? He also seems confused as to what the charges were even about. I would hope the mayor of a major city would know something, anything about an issue before he comments.
And then the juror continues. Furthermore, he states elected officials have, quote, an obligation to be helpful to their constituents, including when appropriate assistance with employment opportunities, writing letters of recommendation for schools, and so on, end quote. Great, continues the juror, but that has nothing to do with what John O'Brien was charged with or with what we found proven. It was made clear from the beginning that political patronage was not illegal, nor was it even illegal that there was a rigged system. What we found him guilty of was mail fraud. What was illegal was that there was a reasonable expectation that U.S. mails would be used, and John's signature stated he complied with the personnel and policy manual, which state hiring must be based on merit. Speaking for myself and no other jurors, as well as being instructed as to what mail fraud actually is, I found that proven beyond a reasonable doubt, which led to the charges of racketeering and conspiracy.
And then the juror continues, I just want to make it clear that this was a hard case for all of us. We didn't take the charges lightly. These are people's lives. Personally, I found O'Brien likable and feel he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. Make the legislature happy or suffer budget cuts and or layoffs of the staff you oversee and care about. He did the wrong things for the right reasons. For the mayor to make the comments he did diminishes our efforts, and his admission that he really didn't know what the case was about is pretty much a slap in our face.
And now the paragraph that the juror wrote to me about the Speaker of the House, and he uses a term that neither of us are familiar with in the first few words here, which leads to Elmo, that's the term, which leads to Elmo and DeLeo. I have followed his statements about the verdict. In no way do I feel our decision exonerated DeLeo. To the contrary, I feel he should have been on trial rather than O'Brien. We found gratuity proven rather than bribery because no witness was able to testify to the conversations that occurred between O'Brien and DeLeo. All of it seemed suspicious, but we had no testimony that spoke to what DeLeo said or did. To feel these jobs were given to DeLeo to hand out for no reason whatsoever strains credulity. However, I feel O'Brien himself is the only person who could prove whether this was a gratuity or a bribe, and he chose not to testify.
Can I read the last paragraph?
You may indeed.
This is a great paragraph. My hope is that John O'Brien himself will at some point testify against DeLeo and exchange any sentence against him or Liz Tavares or Bill Burke, those are the other two defendants, will be lessened or done away with altogether. That's the end of his statement. In other words, he doesn't think they should serve any time. That's the way it sounds to me.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Again, this is an unnamed juror. We confirmed that this person was a juror in the probation trial. Suggests that that the comments the mayor made to us the other day were irresponsible and reckless and borderline ridiculous. And then goes on to say that in no way do I feel our decision exonerated DeLeo, meaning the Speaker of the House. And the final paragraph is also quite heavy. As Marjorie, my hope is that John himself, meaning O'Brien, John himself will at some point testify against DeLeo and in exchange any sentence against him or Liz Tavares or Bill Burke would be lessened or done away with altogether. Our number is 877-301-8970. This is pretty heavy stuff. I mean, it carries no legal weight. A juror does not have the power to prosecute or initiate a prosecution. I've read conflicting things, by the way, back and forth, about whether or not the statute of limitations is run on any potential case against any member of the legislature. But there also have been pieces written saying, well, John O'Brien does not want to leave his family for years and years. If he flips, as they use that term, would he get a lighter sentence if he flipped, meaning testified against certain legislators? Again, our number is 877-301-8970.
You know what this whole situation reminds me of? The mayor's comments. And Marty Walsh, by all accounts, has done a lot of great things. John Conley himself that ran against him declared just a few days ago that he's been a great mayor and he loves him. But Marty Walsh is in the legislature for a long time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Bob DeLeo has been in the legislature for a long time. A lot of them have been there for a long time. It's the old story about the frog put into the water when the water is still cool. You heat up the water, the frog doesn't realize he's about to boil to death. Well, it's as if they've been up there so long that they don't see how to regular Joe and Jane how dirty and corrupt and unfair the system looks. And I don't know what John O'Brien was thinking. At one point, he made some remark about how, you know, these guys are pigs. They're never satisfied.
They're a bunch of pigs pointing to the State House.
You know, so he was frustrated by the requests coming from all sides, from legislators and judges and other people in positions of power and stuff. But it's as if there's this whole Beacon Hill culture that operates with its own set of rules. And when you've been living in that culture for a long time, you somehow forget that this is bad stuff.
Well, you know, also, I think further evidence what you're saying, Marjorie, is, we mentioned this to Brian McGrory, the editor of the Globe, when he was with us yesterday, the fact that, to my knowledge, not one single legislator of the 200, or at least of the Democrats, maybe I shouldn't include the Republicans there, not one single Democrat, to my knowledge, post-verdict, has said, we get the message, we know things have to change, we know the reforms we did in 2011 are not enough, speaks powerfully, I think, to a problem that needs piercing. But let me reiterate something I said, which doesn't – I mean, the juror was there. I wasn't there. I just read accounts of the trial. I am in that camp of people who feel naming Bob DeLeo an unindicted conspirator two-thirds or halfway into the case
– unfair.
With no opportunity to defend himself or testify when she could have indicted him. She could have called – she, Carmen Ortiz, U.S. attorney, could have called him to testify. It doesn't in any way detract what the juror's position is – from the juror's position, but there is a fundamental unfairness. Put yourself in a position – no matter what you think he did or didn't do, of all of it, he is not named in the opening statement by the prosecutors. His name comes up as an unindicted conspirator, part of a quid pro quo, and all he can do is issue press releases and do little briefings outside his office. But again, that's a whole separate issue. 877-301-8970. Again, I got this email last night from a juror. We promised we would protect this particular juror's anonymity once we confirmed that this person was actually a member of this jury. Let's take a couple of phone calls if we can. Ed, you're in Milford. You're first on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey there.
Hi, Jim, Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Sure.
I have no opinion really on the O'Brien verdict, except to say that I assume that a politician on trial is guilty. Although in this day and age, polarized day and age we live in, a trial for reasons of political affiliation is not out of the question. The mayor's comment as to the incorrectness of the verdict may be ill-advised. Again, I really have no issue. The main thing that I took away from the mayor's on your show was his assertion that he had never heard the term unindicted co-conspirator. This is a politician who either is ignorant of or has forgotten probably one of the most important political events in modern American history.
And
yeah,
which was?
Watergate? Yeah. Is the Watergate reference?
Watergate trial, for crying out loud.
Well, can I tell you, I am surely not anyone. My job is not to defend Marty Walsh in any context. I have one thing I have found him to be, whether one disagrees or agrees with what he has to say, the guy is a pretty straight arrow, and I think Marjorie would agree. So I can't explain that away. That is odd. You're right. And he's also a pretty smart character. But he did say that when we did the interview the other day. Ed, thanks for the call.
Well, you know what else is fascinating about this trial? And it says something about the culture of Boston. If you talk to someone who grew up in Boston, they grew up in Dorchester like John O'Brien did, or like Peter Kazis, our colleague here at WGBH, mm-hmm. or South Boston, like my good friend and colleague, former colleague actually at the Boston Herald, Peter Gelsinis. This is what politics is all about. You held signs for people and they took care of you. This is why you were holding signs for people. In a federal court, you don't have a Suffolk County jury that's sort of in the know for these kinds of things, or a city jury. You have people from the suburbs, people that really didn't grow up with this sort of culture, didn't grow up with this kind of expectation. They're sitting there listening to this, and I'm sure they're horrified. And and where people, again, like the culture of Beacon Hill or the culture of those politically connected in Boston is, hey, this is the way it works. As Bill Weld said, this is the former
walruses.
Governor of Massachusetts, who's a Republican, by the way, said this is the Mazzola oil of politics. This is how it works.
Yeah, but let me be careful. You know, Judge Young said repeatedly, at least at the beginning of the trial, and he said it in different ways, patronage is not illegal. I have no problem at all with a legislator in public fashion, recommending someone they know well who supported them if he or she is qualified for the job. And the reason I don't is because they actually know the person, and it's far better to recommend someone you know than someone you don't know. The issue is recommending someone who you know to be wildly unqualified for a position that matters.
That's true.
Being a probation officer or a probation chief is serious stuff.
It's very serious stuff. But I think in that culture, just a couple of steps beyond the old probation thing. I mean, a long time ago, Jim, we had a discussion about Terry Murray, the Senate president, recommending a firefighter that was like 600 and something on the list.
Yep, he was.
And popped him up to the top.
Number one.
Now, did the Ethics Commission do an investigation of her? Was she chastised of the Senate for doing something that was really blatantly bad? Was this firefighter qualified? I don't know. So I guess that's what I'm saying, that things have gotten really warped.
I'm not defending, by the way, that, jumping a list. I'm saying if you have the power to recommend and you pick someone you know well who has helped you, who is eminently qualified for a position, that's not only fine. I think it's very fine because you want it. But this clearly, well, according to the jury, crossed the line. Again, the reason we're having this discussion is I got received an email from a juror in the probation trial who said he considers the comments the mayor made to us and then were subsequently reported in the Globe to be irresponsible, reckless, and borderline ridiculous. And he goes on to say, for those of you just tuned in, he says, about Speaker DeLeo, I followed his statements about the verdict. In no way do I feel our decision exonerated DeLeo. To the contrary, I feel he should have been on trial rather than O'Brien. We found gratuity proven rather than bribery. Those are terms of art, obviously, because no witness was able to testify to the conversations that occurred between O'Brien and DeLeo. All of it seems suspicious, but we had no testimony that spoke to what DeLeo said or did. To feel these jobs were given to DeLeo to hand out for no reason whatsoever strains credulity. However, I feel O'Brien himself is the only person who could prove whether this was a gratuity or bribe. He chose not to testify. And then the takeaway is the final paragraph. The juror says, my hope is that John, meaning O'Brien, that John himself will at some point testify against DeLeo and in exchange, any sentence against him or Liz Tavares or Bill Burke will be lessened or done away with altogether. Now, in fairness to DeLeo, we should say, while the prosecutor said he was an unindicted co-conspirator, they could have indicted. They chose not to indict Bob DeLeo. So that's important
and there
for
were,
people to
there
know.
And there were questions that was all political, too, that was a political decision not to indict him, excuse me.
Made above Carmen Ortiz's head by pure speculation by the Attorney General of the United States, who did not want to see any Democrats in an election year in a defendant's seat in a high-profile federal trial.
And the fourth speaker in a row in Massachusetts, which is really something when you think about it.
Well, but again, he was charged with nothing. You can have your opinion. Obviously, this juror has an informed opinion, but he was charged with nothing.
And the other thing about Bob DeLeo, he's a very personable guy.
He is.
I mean, it's really difficult not to like the guy. I've seen him a million times on your show, talked to him, interviewed him. He seems like a great guy. Anyway, Richard from Watertown. What do you think, Richard?
Hello, Richard.
Well, I don't understand where you folks are coming from. First, Jim, I've had a problem with you for a week because I don't understand your defense of DeLeo. DeLeo wasn't accused from innuendo. DeLeo was part of testimony in a federal court. People testified as to what his role was. And he was given 10 jobs to give out, just to give out. The people didn't even have to apply. And if you think that is innocence, I don't understand.
Richard, excuse me. By the way, I'm not going to cut you off, so don't worry. Let me be clear. I am not defending or condemning Bob DeLeo. What I've said repeatedly is the U.S. attorney who has the power to do what you think she should have done chose not to indict this guy. That's all I have said. And he's in a position sitting in his office hearing his name listed as an unindicted co-conspirator. If Bob DeLeo broke the law as you believe he did, and apparently Carmen Ortiz believes he did by calling him an unindicted co-conspirator, you know what she should have done? She should have indicted him and let the jury hear the case against him. That's my whole case. I don't know what he did. I don't know what's true, what's not true. I'm just telling you that he was not indicted. Continue. I'm sorry, Richard.
Right, but your defense has been more than just that, because he was part of testimony. So it's not like there was some innuendo being done. They didn't try him because they didn't think they could make the case. Now, making a case like this isn't always about guilt and innocence. It's about who you're going to get to testify and who won't testify.
That is true. That is true.
And so that's the reason why he wasn't indicted, because they just didn't think they could make the case. But to say that he's innocent as the pure driven snow.
I didn't say he was innocent as any snow. I've never said he was innocent or guilty.
He was, you know, his name came up in testimony.
Yes.
Before it came up by the attorney general. Now, I think what Carmen Ortiz did is that I don't think she knew how deep he was into it until that testimony came up, and they were totally unprepared for it.
Well, you know, Richard, if I may interrupt again, you know what she should have done at her press conference after the guilty verdict? She should have said that instead of you speculating, which you're entitled to do, about what her motivations were. She was free to say, here's why I didn't indict him. Here's why I only learned, just as you said, she chose not to answer the questions. Continue.
Okay. The mayor.
Yeah.
You know, I heard him say that he's going to oppose all the medical pot shops, their locations and everything.
I didn't hear that, but go ahead.
He said that many times. And, you know, that was passed by a referendum of the voters. You know, at some point you have to respect the voters, just like the Republican stalemate in Congress, they're trying to nullify the election that we elected the president, and they're trying to nullify it by making it impossible for him to govern.
Well, let me be clear, Richard, and thank you for your call. I've never heard him say he voted against it, he told us and told us. I believe this is true. I never heard him say that he's opposing any of what you call the pot shops in Boston. By the way,
medical,
I don't know,
marijuana dispensaries.
To our colleagues,
is that the correct term?
I don't know if the email from the jurors is yet on our website. Can you let us know as soon as it is, so we don't have to read it again, or if people want to actually read the words of this individual juror? If it's not up now at WGBHnews.org, it will be up soon.
You know, we should point out, obviously, that there were many other legislators who were brought up in the course of this trial, asking for jobs for people that were a questionable full qualification. You mentioned Terry Murray, the Senate President. Petrolatti, what was the nickname for him? The representative? He was like the
Patronage King or something
like that. I mean, he was apparently recommending an awful lot of people. So there were other legislators. Jack Hart, former legislator from South Boston, took the stand and said he didn't remember a lot of things. So there were quite a few people. It wasn't just, obviously, DeLeo.
And by the way, in all fairness, I know it was Richard, the first caller, is going to be more aggravated with me. All I'm doing, Richard, is repeating testimony. I'm not suggesting innocence. Both of the state reps who acknowledged that they got a call from DeLeo's office saying, you want to pick somebody for this thing, the allegation was that DeLeo, what he got in return for that call was their votes for speaker. Both, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Marjorie, both reps testified that they had committed to DeLeo before they'd gotten the phone call offering them a job for a constituent or a friend. But again, I'm not condemning him. I'm not indicting him. I'm not clearing him. I'm just stating the facts. And again, this individual juror says, in no way do I feel our decision exonerated DeLeo. And he goes on to say he hopes that O'Brien is going to testify against DeLeo at some point and get a reduced sentence.
Well, one of the great lines in this trial is that, you know, the quid was indicted and the quo was not indicted. So this juror, obviously, Howie Carr said that, wrote that line. And this juror obviously felt that same thing. I've got these people in front of me. I really hope they don't go to jail. But they were, what they were alleged to have done was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So we had to convict them. But I'd like to see the big fish in the defendant's docket as well. And when you're watching this trial, I thought, wrongly, that they were all going to be acquitted because I thought the whole jury would say, well, gee, I'm seeing all these probation people here. Well, where are the legislators? Where are the people that benefited from these jobs? But obviously, from this juror's perspective, they were convinced by the prosecution that the three people, Tavares, O'Brien, and Burke, were guilty as charged.
And by the way, just so that Marjorie does not stand out there alone, there's somebody else who I respect a lot. That'd be me, who thought the exact same thing, that there'd be an acquittal because of who was not there, namely some legislator. By the way, just to evince our fairness here, we have invited the Speaker of the House to join us. He was on TV with me the other night. He has never said no to an invitation. They have a massive session today, and I guarantee you that we will continue to extend it, and either tomorrow or next week we would hope to get the Speaker's reaction to what this juror said about him.
Let's go to Ed from New Hampshire. None of this goes on up there, Ed, does it? Does it go on in New Hampshire at all? Don't your legislators get $100 a year or something like that?
Yeah, that's about all.
Yeah, okay. What do you think, Ed?
I just had a question overall. I think Jim brought up an extremely important point about this whole topic, is the patronage positions. What if the patronage positions go to someone who's not qualified? I work in Massachusetts at a public facility that is run by a person who's woefully not capable, and that was a patronage position from a fairly well-known politician. It was, it's pretty amazing to me how that can be done so wide open. That seems to me to be the issue of illegality, I would say.
Yeah, but of course, as the judge pointed out over and over again, as unseemly and terrible and bad for everybody as that seems to be, it's not a crime. It is just not a crime. I mean, it used to be much more blatant. Ed, I remember years ago in the 60s and 70s and stuff, there would be actual patronage offices. You know, the city of New York had a patronage office.
Called that, was it not?
Yes. I mean, it's not illegal, although you're right. It's bad.
Ed, thanks for the call. I want to read another section that I read a minute ago from this juror's letter that addresses exactly the point that Ed was making. It was made clear from the beginning that political patronage was not illegal, nor was it even illegal. There was a rigged system. What we found him, meaning O'Brien, guilty of was mail fraud. What was illegal was that there was a reasonable expectation that U.S. mails would be used, and John's signature stated he complied with the personnel and policy manual, which states hiring must be based on merit. Speaking for myself and no other jurors, as well as being instructed as to what mail fraud actually is, I found that proven beyond a reasonable doubt, which led to the charges of racketeering and conspiracy, meaning they had to be demonstrated, at least to this juror's mind, and I believe to the judge's mind, that the sum of the recommendations and hirings were for people who were clearly on their face unqualified.
And we should point out there are many very brilliant legal minds who think this whole prosecution was ridiculous. Harvey Silverglate is one of them and says that you know, to be convicted of a crime, you have to really understand it's a crime, and he was defending O'Brien, saying, "Did O'Brien even know this was a crime?" And he thought that the federal government twisted racketeering and misused racketeering. What do you most associate racketeering charges with? The mob,
yes.
You know, so that it was twisted around because they wanted to find a way to. Is this really racketeering? Was Silverglate's argument?
You know, and also speaking of Bob DeLeo's willingness, unlike the Senate president, I should say, to do interviews, a couple of times ago when Bob DeLeo was on my show, I asked him the following question, which I actually believe hit on something, even though he said it was not true. I said, "Is it possible that you violated the law, statutory law, but didn't think you were violating the law, meaning that it was not a willful crime, but that you did something that technically is absolutely illegal, but you didn't think?" Of course, he said, "No, that's not the case." But, you know, it gets to your thing. This is how it's done. This is, as evidence, if people say, "Jim, you're full of it," well, then why is not one Democratic legislator said, "Boy, did we ever get a message from that verdict the other day? We know we got to change the way we do business." Not one. Not one. DeLeo at least had the decency to admit that his reputation was tarnished. She said it repeatedly. But not one Democratic legislator said, "Boy, we escaped by the skin of our teeth and we have gotten the message." Let's take one or two more quick ones.
Christopher just emailed from New Hampshire, where this doesn't go on either, of course, because their legislators make no money.
$65? What is it, $100?
I think it's $100 bucks or something. It's a gentleman's legislature. But Christopher says, "I hope this big mess convinces the voters in Massachusetts they need to break the one-party rule and vote for Charlie Baker."
Well, that's what Baker has said. I mean, Baker has said repeatedly, this proves that one party rule does not. And by the way, the guy who is running against Charlie Baker in the Republican primary, Mark Fisher, will be with us in just a couple of minutes. Let's just get one more quick one. Norm, you're in Waltham. Thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanks. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I wanted to present a naive and idealistic point of view.
Okay. Good.
I believe that there should be no patronage. The system should only be merit-based because it puts at a disadvantage all the other candidates who are qualified but don't have any connection to the legislators. And any intervention by legislators should be restricted to trying just to remedy the system if the merit-based process did not work. For example, a long time ago I applied for a federal summer job. It was an exam-based thing. I got some veterans points added. I had a great score. I didn't get contacted for a job. So eventually I contacted Senator Kennedy's office. They looked into it. They, you know, fixed the process. They got me the job. But it was all merit-based. You know what I mean?
Yes, we do know what you mean.
No, except that you called Kennedy's office and he helped you get the job. So you could say it was not all merit-based. You had, but you know what the problem with this is?
Norm, thanks.
Because we're up against the clock here. Yeah. But, you know, I don't want to get rid of all patronage because there are instances where politicians want to have an inner circle of people that they can trust
yeah.
and then have political savvy and skills. And there are a lot of people that were very qualified on paper who have no political savvy and skills. I mean, you find this all the time in new administrations where Deval Patrick appointed people he knew well who didn't turn out so well. Barack Obama has appointed people that were friends of his from Chicago who people would argue did not turn out so well. So, you know, in some cases it works, in some cases it doesn't. You don't want people totally unqualified.
By the way, we want to thank this juror who we are not naming at this person's request for having the courage to sit down and write a very thoughtful piece. Again, we will solicit the response of the mayor, who is mentioned here, and, of course, the Speaker of the House. By the way, there's an article in the Boston Globe right now on its website, bostonglobe.com, about that. And the full text of the email that we received is now available to you at WGBHnews.org.
You know, should JFK have appointed his brother, RFK, as the Attorney General, Jim?
Well, that was a big issue, by the way. And wasn't there legislation filed about all the – what's that thing called?
I don't know. You can't appoint your brother Attorney
General.
Nepotism,
yes. Well, I mean, I think there was an anti-nepotism thing filed after that. I'm not sure. In any case,
okay.
Go check it out, WGBHnews.org or BostonGlobe.com.
We are continuing our series of conversations with the people running for governor. Excuse me. And joining us in Studio 3 is Mark Fisher to tell us about his campaign for governor of Massachusetts. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
When it comes to real estate, we know that what matters is location, location, location. But that's also true for cities themselves.
Dubai's location used to be a disaster. It's way too hot. Its port is very limited. But from an air perspective, Dubai's an amazing location.
I'm Kara Miller, the super cities of the 21st century, this week on Innovation Hub, tonight at 9 on WGBH Radio.
WGBH Radio exists because of you and Harvard Extension School, offering environmental management and sustainability courses, certificates, and degrees. Registration through September 1st. More information available at extension.harvard.edu. And Blythewald Mansion, offering music at sunset overlooking Narragansett Bay on the Great Lawn at Blythewald Mansion Gardens and Arboretum in Bristol, Rhode Island, every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. through August. More at blythewald.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're continuing our series of conversations with gubernatorial candidates. Here with us in Studio 3 today is Mark Fisher. Mark owns Merchants Fabrication in Auburn. It's a metal manufacturing facility. He's running on the Republican ticket against Charlie Baker. Mark, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you again, Jim and Marjorie.
Thank you very much for coming in. We're going to start this with what we call in the business a softball question, because I thought this was a great story, and I bet you love telling it. And people can relate to this because a lot of people have been unemployed and been out of work, and you've experienced this several times in your life. You talk about getting laid off in 2008. And that very same day that you received your notice, something happened. Tell people that story.
Yeah, I was looking for a business for sale, and I found one. The very same day that I got my layoff notice, I found a business for sale. It took a long time to finally close the deal. It was in the fall of 2008, and business wasn't very good. The banks didn't want to give me a loan. And we finally closed the following August, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So how, if you were laid off, could you buy a business?
Interesting. So that's what the banks wanted to know, too. I had to take a loan on my house. They wanted a lien on my mom's house. They wanted a personal guarantee. They also wanted a life insurance policy, which they got on my life. I paid the premium. So if I failed, they go after my house, they go after my mom's house, they go after my property, and if it causes me so much stress that I die, they collect on the insurance policy.
Okay, well, for your mother's sake, I'm glad things didn't went okay. So you've been right in the middle of this whole immigration battle. You're up at the State House when they had the big protest against bringing the children and the teenagers that have come from other countries.
Stop the invasion rally.
That's right. What is your stand on this whole issue, Mark Fisher, please?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I said at the rally... we're compassionate people, and we want to help people. And we're helping illegal immigrants now in this state to the tune of over $200,000 and $2 billion a year. And when I hear the mayor of Lynn, Judy Kennedy, talk about what it's doing to her town and Chelsea and Saugus and Chicopee, I think we're over the limit. So when I talk to people about this who are on the other side of the issue, I say, what's the limit? How many can Massachusetts afford to take in? And I think we're way over that now.
So what do you do with these kids who, at least according to DeVal Patra, the current governor, would be on these bases, one in Western Mass, one in Bourne? Kids are here. As a result of a law signed by George Bush in 2008, they can, even if it was a great idea, they can't just be deported. They have due process rights. They got to be somewhere until they've had an opportunity to exhaust those due process rights. What would you do with them if not have them here, Mark Fisher?
Yeah, I guess 2 points. If I was governor, you know, a few months ago, and I was asked by Barack Obama, I would say the same answer that Governor Malloy in Connecticut and the governors in other Democratic states have said: no. This is your problem.
What is that? But the federal government is made up of 50 states and D.C.
Yeah.
They got to be in one of those states or D.C. or two of them. What is he supposed to do? Take him to the White House?
Yeah.
I don't mean that facetiously. Where is he supposed to put him while he's complying with the George Bush law?
In addition to George Bush's law, he has this deferred action. So people are coming to the border knowing they can get in and they can't be turned away and they have to wait 3 years in line to go before a judge. This is a federal problem. I guess you put them on federal basis somewhere. But
that's what he wants to do. He wants to put them on federal basis here.
But if they're asking our permission in Massachusetts, I say no.
Well, suppose, and it would be a promise, and you'd have to believe the promise were true, but suppose there were a promise that we're not going to have these kids in school in Lynn and Brockton. We're not going to burden the budgets there. We're not going to have people living here indefinitely. That it is what DeVal Patrick has said. It's going to be a short-term stay, all federal dollars. In that case, if that were you believe that to be true, would that be different?
No, and here's the reason why. Lou Evangelitis, sheriff in Central Mass, went down. He knows that there's a backlog of over 3 years for people to get before a judge. So it's 4 months and at least 3 years. And we've heard these promises before about the tolls would come down when the turnpike was paid for, that the income increase in the income tax is temporary and so forth. We've heard all these promises before.
But, Mark, that's not the answer to her question. It is fine to be skeptical. We're talking to Mark Fisher, a Republican candidate for governor. And obviously it's fine to be skeptical. There are a lot of good reasons to be skeptical about a lot of things. But Marjorie is posing a hypothetical. Mm-hmm. If you were assured as governor, as you have to be as governor, a whole variety of things before you. If you were assured that the representations made by both the federal government and your predecessor, DeVal Patrick, were accurate, that it's a finite period of time, much shorter than 3 years, it's 100% federally funded, purely on federal land, you still say – how can you say no? It complies with all the conditions you're talking about.
Then I would say find something closer to the border and don't incur the cost of bringing them up here with the airplanes.
Okay. We're talking to Mark Fisher, who is challenging Charlie Baker, or vice versa, depending on your point of view. Guns.
Yeah.
Apparently this has been resolved, but there was a major dispute at the State House over the final version of, as I'm sure you know, a gun bill. Police chiefs were on the side of the Speaker of the House saying the same discretion police chiefs have to declare someone not suitable to have a license to carry a handgun, that same discretion should be granted to these police chiefs when deciding whether to give a license for a rifle or a shotgun. The Senate, 28-10, had voted against such a provision. Where are you on that? Where were you on that, Mark Fisher?
I say in Massachusetts, we have some of the strictest gun laws in the country. And let's solve some real problems. I think that government incompetence with DCF, the drug lab scandal, the compounding farm scandal has caused more harm and responsible for more deaths than any law-abiding gun owners. Let's solve those problems.
So, but the answer,
waste of time.
Would the answer be no?
No.
To that? So no. So if, to be consistent, if they don't have the power, police chiefs, to consider suitability when, as it relates to rifles and shotguns, should they also not have the power to make a decision based upon suitability as they currently have with handguns to be consistent?
Well, I mean, I went to get my FID card, and they do have some discretion there.
On handguns. Handguns. I'm saying, but to be consistent, if you don't want them to have it for rifles and shotguns, should they also not have it for handguns?
Yeah, it should be consistent. But here's the thing, Jim. There are 90 – when I get my FID card, there were 98 laws. If you broke any one of them, you couldn't own a gun in Massachusetts. So – the moral of the story is if you want a good neighbor, find yourself a law-abiding gun owner because they're already vetted by the police chief in the state of Massachusetts.
We're talking to Mark Fisher, who's running for governor against Charlie Baker. Mark, you know, I read your bio and you talk a lot about money that we spend on welfare and SNAP and food stamps and that kind of stuff. And I'm interested because you worked yourself for Raytheon.
Yeah.
That I don't hear a lot about corporate tax breaks and deals that we make with these big corporations to stay in Massachusetts. I would assume, especially having worked for Raytheon, which did you wrong, that you would where are you on the big corporate tax breaks?
And Raytheon got one, by the way.
Raytheon got one, and not only, correct me if I'm wrong, took a lot of jobs out of state.
Yeah, I'm opposed to corporate welfare. And that's
okay.
That's what I call it. I don't think we should target, and I said this, I think, to Jim earlier, I call the tax targeting of specific industries, fad industries like Evergreen Solar. We should make a level playing field across the board. I'm for lowering the tax rate across the board to help businesses come in here, but not target specific industries. By the way, New York, liberal New York, is the second leading state in job creation. Why? They have no tax zones, and it's attracting businesses there. We can do the same thing here in Massachusetts.
And I know you were happy about the recent decision about the buffer zone outside the abortion clinics, mm-hmm. where they were 35 feet. Now they've been lowered to 25 feet. Where are you in abortion, period? You pro-life?
Pro-life.
So what would happen to women under the Mark Fisher administration that had abortions?
Well, I know people, I know women who've had abortions, who've had multiple abortions, who've survived the abortion attempts on their own lives.
I mean, if it were illegal, would you indict them?
Oh, my goodness, no.
So would happen. They could get abortions and you would not.
I want them to get information. There's an enterprise institute that says 64% of women who get abortions feel like they've been coerced into it. I want to give them
by
more.
By whom?
By their boyfriends, their husbands, their parents, their employers sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if it were illegal, though, if it were against the law to get an abortion, you couldn't legally get an abortion. So what would happen to the women that broke the law to get an abortion?
Yeah, I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
You know, Mark, I mentioned a minute ago, after Marjorie was candid enough to admit she was wrong in her prediction about the probation trial verdict, that I was wrong in the same way. I may have been wrong about you, too, and I'll tell you why. When I met you, you were on my show, television show, nonstop. You were challenging the decision of the state committee, state Republican committee, which said you had not gotten the required threshold of 15%. You said you did. Ultimately, a deal was cut where they said, yeah, you're on the ballot and that sort of thing. You were all over the place. You were in the news. It's almost like you've had milk carton status, I think. I don't mean this harshly. You've raised $40,000 while Baker's raised $1 million and something. I don't mean this critically at all. I mean, and if I'm wrong, I hope you'll correct me. It seems your presence, I don't get it. We get emails from all the candidates to the point where you can't even, you know, see your other emails in your inbox. How seriously are you campaigning
in
this thing?
So if anybody wants to know that, go to my website, go to the events tab. My schedule is public. I have 4 events today.
Wow.
I was on Fox News this morning. You guys, I got Access Framingham this afternoon.
So
and
I'm
got
wrong?
Barbecue in West Roxbury.
Am I wrong?
You're wrong.
How are you going to campaign then? Assuming that's the case, and I know you to be a straight arrow, so I assume it's true. How do you win a primary with $40,000 in the bank?
Virginia, David Bratt. versus $5 million.
He did beat one guy down there.
On.
Yes,
that's
he did.
True. That is very true. And your politics are close to his.
Yeah, exactly. It's not $40,000. It's more like $340,000. Still a small change compared.
Oh,
to
I Charlie saw it was $39,000. I read
balancing it, but raised.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Available. You know, one of the last thing, but I assume we're going to get emails like I got when you were first on television with me, saying, "Oh, Jim, you're disparaging Mark Fisher by regularly referring to him as a Tea Party candidate."
Oh, I'm
you
proud
don't shy
of that.
Away
I'm
from
proud
that.
Of that.
Every
Come
time
on.
You're on television, you have a teacup with you. What is it about Tea Party politics that you think Massachusetts is ready for, Mark Fisher?
Well, I think this is a perfect segue because I stopped on my way through East Bridgewater yesterday and I got out of my car and stood with the Market Basket employees. Whether it's the establishment of a business, whether it's the establishment of a political party, whether it's the establishment of our government, I think it's the spirit of the Tea Party. I'm not saying that the Market Basket people call themselves Tea Party members, but I think it's the spirit of the Tea Party to say, listen, the establishment isn't working for us. They're working against us. And we want to do things about it, whether it's standing out or putting their jobs on the line or things like that. And I think that's what it's all about.
So you're siding with the march? I mean, I know you stood with them, you protested with them. You're with the protesting market basket workers?
I say more power to them. And I caution them to say, listen, you know what's happened in the past? And I referenced the PATCO union thing with Ronald Reagan and how—
When he fired all the air traffic controllers.
And that's the ultimatum that the market basket establishment is saying to them. And I heard on the news this morning that people are saying, you know, we're willing to do that. And they're not going to be able to pay for their college or this, that, and the other thing. Man, is that what a sacrifice that is.
You know, both Charlie Baker told me on TV the other night and Deval Patrick told us in the studio last week that as current governor and as hoped for governor, they both use similar terms. Private company, private enterprise. I really hope good things happen. I hope the workers are protected. As governor, I wouldn't intervene and try to do anything. I don't have any power. Would you?
Same here. No.
You sit it out.
I was there with them.
No, but as governor.
But as a governor. No. That's government involvement. No.
Even though thousands of jobs might be at risk, small vendors are about to go under. A major business could also go under. You don't think there's any role for a governor in that kind of setting?
No. Something will fill the vacuum there. There's a need. People need that supermarket. And whether it's Market Basket or some other name, it'll be a free market thing.
We're talking with Mark Fisher, who's running for governor. You know, Mark, I think there's a lot that appeals the Tea Party to people if they're fiscal conservatives and they're worried about spending too much money and they're worried about their taxes and stuff like that. But a lot of the Tea Party, not everybody, but a lot of the Tea Party gets into the social issues, where it's kind of like you're talking about the pro-life kind of thing, that in Massachusetts makes it almost impossible for even if you are a fiscal conservative to align with you. You know, there's a whole lot of people.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Here's what I say.
Never thought of kind of, we'll leave the social issues out of this and just talk about fiscal conservatism.
For example, the young woman who seconded my nomination at the convention, she's pro-choice.
Yeah.
She knows that I'm pro-life. She's still supporting me. Here's what I'd like to say. The recent Supreme Court decision, 9-0. Liberals and conservatives on the bench were agreed. The ACLU agreed with the decision. And I'm standing with that. I think, Marjorie, that those people that are taking the side of the new buffer zone law in Massachusetts, now 25 feet, if you can't agree with what the Supreme Court said and the ACLU, which I think should be hailed by pro-life and pro-choice people, then I think you're showing your true colors as not pro-choice but pro-abortion.
So where are you on the whole marijuana thing, medical and regular old legalization?
Medical, fine. That's between a patient and a doctor.
Okay.
On the other stuff, I say, listen, Washington and Colorado running the experiment, there's a few things I don't like. I've heard about young kids going to the emergency room because they swallowed candy with it laced in it. And are you under the influence when you're driving? They've got to be tested for it. Let them run the experiment.
Okay.
Let's see the results before we try to do it here in Massachusetts.
How about casinos?
I'm against them.
Why?
I don't think we'd ever even be considering it, Marjorie, if we had good-paying jobs here in the first place. I think we've driven jobs out of Massachusetts. I want to make it business-friendly like New York is. And bring good-paying jobs here. I don't like the fact that the remaining jobs, never mind the construction jobs, but the remaining jobs are based on the fact that people have to go there, lose their money to support the jobs at the casinos.
So you're voting for repeal of
voting
the
for repeal.
On the ballot question?
Yep. Now, if it passes, I'm a governor. I got to respect the will of the people.
So I was in Springfield, and I'm not a huge casino fan. I think I've made that clear. I was in Springfield, I don't know, a month ago, and I drove around the perimeter of the area where the casino, which has been awarded – well, technically it hasn't been awarded. That's not the term. It's been chosen but not awarded, so they don't have to pay some huge fee in case the thing is repealed. But essentially, Springfield's getting a casino, assuming the thing isn't repealed. Mm-hmm. They need something in Springfield. And while a lot of us say our first preference would not be a casino – Governor Fisher, what do you do for Springfield to generate economic activity? I've said this quote a million times. When years and years and years ago, long before the law, we were talking about casinos on the air, Marjorie and I, on our former radio station, and I was saying I wasn't crazy about them. Unsolicited, Barney Frank calls in, who represented the district, the part of the state where a casino would have gone. I don't know if it was a Native American casino or not. And he said, Jim, I have a great idea. Let's build the casino with those crappy jobs you're talking about. And as soon as you find better jobs for those people, we'll shut it down and transfer them to the new place. Now, obviously, he's being facetious. What do you do for the people of Springfield?
Yeah, very quickly, I want to do what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin. He had tens of billion dollars in debt. And in 3 years, they have a $1 billion surplus, making it business friendly across the board, not just for Springfield, the South Shore, the North Shore, the Cape, but across the board. By reducing the corporate tax rate, eliminating the overburdensome rules and regulations, stop taxpayer funding of fad industries, $58 million to Evergreen Solar, and then eliminating the inventory tax, Jim. Springfield's at the crossroads of 90 and 91. It would be a haven for distribution centers, and that means material handling jobs, logistics jobs, transportation jobs, administrative jobs. It would be a boon here for Massachusetts.
We're talking to Mark Fisher, who's running for governor. You know, there was this really weird story a few months ago, but now that you're here, I want to get to the bottom of this whole thing. You had sued the GOP to get onto the ballot, and then there was this weird back and forth where they said that you demanded, this is the Mass GOP, that you demanded $1 million from them to drop the lawsuit. You said it was the other way around. Mm-hmm. So what's the story here, Mark Fisher?
Yeah, Jim asked me that. Did you ask for $1 million? I said, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get the specific language, so their attorney's asking us for a number. I said, no, there is no number. I said, listen, tell them it's the same ridiculous number they offered me back in December, $1 million. I should have said $17 trillion.
Okay.
So what's the status of that, by the way? I know obviously they gave you ballot access, but what you told me and others is I'm not done with this thing. I want to see the ballots. I want to prove that in your estimation, they essentially committed fraud, is your contention, correct?
I say they cheated and they got caught cheating. Here's the thing. I've told them, you release the tally sheets, and if they show what you say they show, no impropriety, I'll drop the lawsuit. The ball's in their court. Release the tally sheets.
So this lawsuit is still pending?
The judge split it, Jim, into two points. Uh-huh. One, to get me on the ballot. That was removed because they put me on the ballot. The second one's for damages, and that could play out over 2 or 3 years.
You know, Mark,
before we leave this, do we ever find out who's going to pay you the $1 million?
Well, there were some names named, and I went public with those names.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We'll go public with them again.
I was told by a state committee man that to call a fellow named John Cook, who I've never met, by the way. I got his phone number. We played phone tag. That's the name I had, John Cook.
Where'd you get $1 million?
That's a good question to ask him, Marjorie.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
Just want to stay on this for 1 second. What you also said, I think the last time I spoke with you, Mark, you said that you thought that the level of the behavior on the part of the state GOP to deny you ballot access may have risen to criminality, correct?
Yep.
Have you spoken to any prosecutors about that?
No, I think at the press conference I mentioned Martha Coakley. She's still the attorney general. She still has a job to do if she wants to look into that. But
you also suggested, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you think your opponent, Charlie Baker, may have been part of this deal.
Yeah.
Do you have any evidence that Baker had anything to do with messing with ballots to ensure that you didn't gain primary ballot status?
Initially, I didn't say that. But based on what we've seen come out and delegates telling us what came out and actually people who were responsible for the tally sheets, I think his fingerprints are all over this.
And how so?
That's why the tally sheets won't come out.
How so?
Because he was the only one who was the beneficiary of this. And the people who were doing it were Baker people.
Do you think he committed a crime? If you think the state GOP did Charlie Baker commit a crime?
I'll leave that for a jury to decide.
Well, but you think the state GOP committed a crime. Why are you not willing to say whether you think Baker did or not?
Well, we need to get those tally sheets and see. Those tally sheets and see.
You know, we have an email, and we get a lot of questions about this proposed pipeline, so I'm going to read it. This is from Bob. If Mark Fisher is against corporate welfare, how does he feel about the Kinder Morgans, a private company, of course, their proposal that their proposed pipeline through Massachusetts is paid for by a surcharge on Massachusetts ratepayers?
I was up in Orange last night and met with about 20 people, and emotions are really running high up there on the issue. And myself and Karen Anderson, who's running for a state rep, said this. Listen, we want to know the facts. But there's two principles that I want to keep in mind. We need other sources of low-cost energy. Gas seems to be ideal, clean burning. But we also have to take into consideration the rights and concerns of the residents up there. And I don't know how those two can be met. We have gas distribution pipelines in Massachusetts now. We have electrical things. It's about easements and property. We can't please all the people all the time, but those two things have to be taken into consideration with any decision.
You know, Mark, before you go, you seem to be having fun.
Oh, this is invigorating.
You know, you can always tell when I think I can tell when a candidate says they're having fun. I love meeting the people. You can tell when they don't really mean it. You seem to be having a spectacular. Why is this? Is your 15 minutes in the of fame, or
no.
What is that? What is it?
You know, I'm an engineer. I'm kind of an introvert. This is not in my nature to go ahead and do this. But when I've gone out and done this stuff, it's invigorating. Sharing ideas like this. Yeah.
So one last thing for me. I mean, you're not expected to beat Charlie Baker. Convince people that they would not waste their vote by voting for Mark Fisher.
Yeah. About a month and a half ago, the Globe ran a poll. And to their surprise, they found that 14% of the state identifies itself as being members of the Tea Party. Only 11% identifies itself as being members of the Republican Party. So if I can turn them out, I win. By the way, only after 3 months of campaigning, I beat Charlie in 2 Senate districts at the convention, and I tied him in 1. And that's after all the arm twisting. So I think my chances are very, very good.
Mark, what's your website?
www.markfisher.com. 2014.com.
Mark, it's good to see you.
Thanks for coming in.
Be well.
Thank you very, very much for coming in. Mark Fisher is a Republican running for governor. He's the owner of Merchants Fabrication in Auburn, a metal manufacturing facility. Coming up, we look at the people who helped to make Boston what it is today. It's the subject of a new book told in the spirit of Howard Zinn and Studs Terkel. Jim Vrabel, the author of The People's History of the New Boston, joins us next on 89.7 WGBH.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on? More great stuff on WGBH. It's possible through our vehicle donation program. All you need is a clear title, and we'll take care of the rest. We'll even handle the towing, and next year, you might just get a tax refund. To learn more, visit wgbh.org/cardonation.
Support for WGBH comes from you and the Boston Speaker Series, proudly presented by Lesley University. 7 evenings at Symphony Hall, now in its 4th season. More information online at bostonspeakerseries.org. Sponsored by Dedham Savings. And It's Your Move, Inc. Oftentimes, adult children are not available to help parents with later life moves. It's Your Move specializes in these challenging emotional life transitions. More info available at itsyourmoveinc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And during the recent mayoral race, and certainly with talk about hosting the Olympics potentially in Boston, we've heard the phrase world-class city used a lot to describe this town. What we don't hear so much about are the people who made it one. That was until recently, thanks to James Vrabel's latest book, The People's History of the New Boston. We're reminded of the community activists, people like Mel King, Henry Lee, who worked to make Boston the city that it is today. Maybe we're seeing the same dedication and activism alive and well in the current Market Basket uprising. Jim Vrabel joins us in Studio 3. Jim, great to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on doing a great job and having great pictures of these demonstrations that,
yeah,
you know, I had forgotten about, some of which I didn't even know about, which we'll get to in a second. But you talk about how, and it is true, back in the 1950s, 1960s, Boston was pretty much a seedy backwater, and things have changed. So what was it like then?
Well, it was. It was called a hopeless backwater and a rundown has-been of a city. And
was that accurate?
It was accurate. It was accurate both for Boston and for a lot of cities. What I tried to do in the book, however, is to show that it wasn't just a few people, mostly white, well-off men, who turned the city around.
Like mayors and developers.
Like mayors and developers, yeah. And they generally get the credit. And people usually talk about the bricks and mortar improvements in the downtown and the waterfront. And what I tried to show in the book is that there were a lot of people, many of them people of color, many of them women, many of them not very well off, and they deserve at least as much credit for making the new Boston what it is.
We want to hear some of those stories because some of them are totally great, inspiring, and probably not known by many of our listeners and us. But before we do, stay with Marjorie's question. Tell us what Boston was like as best as you can, the old Boston, before you start writing about the changes that make it what it is today, Jim Vrabel.
Well, it was a city without office buildings. The old John Hancock was the last tall building built, and that was 1947. It had no skyline. In fact, the vice president of Boston College was flying into Boston one night, and he looked down and said, "Where's Boston?" because he couldn't find it. And that ended up being the name of the exhibit at the Prudential Center. But it was actually a denigrating remark, "Where is Boston?" And it was really off the map. And a lot of it was because of the people who owned the city, the Yankees, couldn't get along with the people who were running the city, who were the Irish Catholic politicians. And there'd been years of fighting that had kind of derailed Boston in the first half of the 20th century.
Well, you think about Boylston Street now, and this is not, the neighborhood stuff that you get into in your book, too, but it's a great symbol when you think about how going along Boylston Street there by the side of the Boston Common, there was the Playboy Club, and there was the very seedy combat zone, and that's when I was a kid.
I remember it well.
You were a little nervous about parking your car, and now that's, correct me if I'm wrong, where the Four Seasons is and all these beautiful swank condominiums and everything else.
It's true. And what happened was that Boston benefited by being an education center and by being close to actually 128. 128 actually built the new Boston in terms of the downtown, because while all the tech jobs went out to the suburbs, all the lawyer jobs and the finance jobs and the lending jobs were in Boston, and that promoted the growth of the tall towers in downtown Boston.
That's the voice of Jim Vrabel. His book is A People's History of the New Boston. So pick, for starters, a story that you love, that you're convinced the vast majority of people listening to the show have never heard of but should have, Jim Vrabel.
Well, I'd start with Ruth Batson.
Do it.
Ruth Batson was a mother of three kids whose own mother showed her the importance of graduation of education by coming back to school, graduating from the eighth grade of the school in which Ruth was a student. When Ruth became a mother and had kids of her own, she started to ask, what are they teaching these kids in the schools? And started to go to meetings. And she said, from that time on, I lost all my fear of important people and speaking in public and speaking my mind. And she led the crusade that at least attempted to put the Boston public schools back on track. And there are hundreds of people like Ruth Batson. I say in the beginning of the book, these are only some of the stories and some of the people. There were hundreds of them.
Well, here's one I never even heard of. These Mothers of Maverick Square, and you get a great picture of all these women out in the street in front of these big, huge trucks. And Maverick Square is in East Boston,
right,
far away from downtown. So what was that all about?
Well, that led by Anna DeFranzo, the Mothers of Maverick Street, she said, we had enough. Someday I'm going to call everybody, we're going to come out in the street, and we're going to stop those trucks. And it was both the expansion of Logan Airport, but also the use by Mass Port Authority that ran Logan Airport of the neighborhood streets for their trucks. 400 trucks a day came up and down Maverick Street. And one day they said, that's it, we've had it. And they went out and they sat down with their kids and their baby carriages, and they stopped dead.
And there were dozens and dozens and dozens of them.
Oh, yes, there were. And for days and days, they stopped the trucks dead. The late, great Alan Lupo, who worked here and everywhere.
At the Globe, at the Herald, one of the
true
great people ever.
You quote him a lot, which is great to see.
He really was the kind of father of community journalism in Boston,
mm-hmm.
And he's really missed. But he talked about how, as a result of the Mothers of Maverick Street, Governor Sargent and Mayor White went into a meeting with Ed King, who ran the Mass Port Authority, and they took a vote. And Eddie King lost every vote they took. So from that time on, Massport started to be reined in because of the work of those mothers.
You know, one of the things you say at the beginning of your book is how we, you know, years ago we were at big in the abolitionist movement, and we were big, of course, in history and the founding of our country and all that kind of stuff. And then things sort of stopped. And then we kind of came alive again in the 60s with Vietnam and tenants' rights and stuff. You've got some great pictures, again, of these big tenant rights rent control protests.
Oh,
tell
yeah.
people about those.
Well, rent control, which we used to have until the voters
have.
Of Massachusetts
That's right.
repealed it on the ballot. But go ahead, Jim.
Well, interesting story about that. The voters of Massachusetts repealed it on the ballot. There were only three communities that still had it. Those three communities voted overwhelmingly for it.
Cambridge, Boston, and Brookline?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the rest of the state said, no, you can't have it anymore. That doesn't seem quite right if you follow.
But you go back to, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
I was going to say, you worked for many years for the BRA. We had the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh, here the other day, and one of his big campaign issues was to reform the BRA. You're not there anymore.
No,
right?
I'm not.
Okay, so you can be
That's
honest
why he wrote
about
this book, to atone for his service.
Yeah,
is that not
so
it?
So there's been a lot of criticism of the BRA, financial mismanagement and so forth, but there's also been criticism of the BRA for a lack of planning. You were there. You understand the way it works. What should the BRA have been doing that they haven't been to make things better in Boston?
Not to try to get off the hook, but I would like to take this back to the 1950s and 60s
when
the BRA was started. And the BRA was started to try to redevelop Boston, which needed redevelopment. I was listening to your show yesterday, and you talk a lot about Market Basket, but you were also talking about the show on Iraq to show that the
losing
best,
Iraq, yes. the front line,
that the best
please.
And the brightest don't always know what they're talking about. Mm. Well, the BRA was created at a time when the best and the brightest, people like Ed Logue, thought they knew what to do to fix cities. Val Hyman is a neighborhood activist in the South End, and he has a great line. He said, we thought the BRA was out to destroy our neighborhood. Took us a while to figure out they didn't know what the hell they were doing. The fact is that this kind of public policy, any kind of public policy, and Jim, you know from your involvement, is very complicated. It's very difficult to decide what the right thing is to do. But the first thing you have to do is listen to the people who are going to be involved in this. And the movement to not just to oppose urban renewal in the 50s and 60s, but to improve it was led by people in the neighborhoods who said, stop, we don't want this plan. We might take this part of it. We might do this. We might do that. And because people rose up after the West End was taken, because they rose up in Charlestown, in Roxbury, in the South End, and everybody, every place else, urban renewal was improved and the product was much better for the next next 10 or 15 years when urban renewal was funded.
Jim, can we get back to – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, explain the West End briefly to people that don't know what that entailed, that mess.
Well, the West End of Boston was an area of four- and five-story tenement buildings. The buildings were in better shape than today's North End buildings, which are seen to be so quaint and so valuable. But as in one of the early attempts at urban renewal, the second, after the New York streets in the South End, the West End was the second, they decided that they were going to demolish the whole area and displace 7,000 people and build a series of high-rise towers. Originally, half of the units were going to be made available for the residents, but a funny thing happened on the way to the development of the project. All the units were luxury housing, and all the residents were displaced. Residents did object, and they held meetings and protests and went to Washington. They did all the right things, but people didn't have the concept at the time that they could actually stop this. And they didn't have the allies. Getting back to Alan Lupo, he had a theory of the four Ps. If the people are going to impress the politicians, they need to get the press and the planners on their side. And the press and
what was the fourth P?
The planners, advocacy planners, okay. Urban Planning Aid, GBCD, places like that, that gives some legitimacy to the people to say, no, that's a stupid idea. We don't want that density. We don't want that road here. We want it here. We want this instead of that. If the politicians are just hearing people say it, it's not impressed on them. But if they can get some professional planners to back up the people, then they'll listen and get the press to listen. And because the press, led by Alan Lupo, started to listen, started to give these people who previously had no voice a voice, then the politicians listened, and then the rest happened. We're better than it would have.
To Jim Brable, he's written a great book, A People's History of the New Boston. Jim, I know this is about Boston, and I know there's not a market basket in Boston, but is that spirit that you write about in your book, do you see that in these workers who are putting their jobs at risk, putting their families at risk?
Oh, I definitely see
that. To go back to what it once was, a very, they say, very employee-friendly, very customer-friendly kind of workplace.
Well, I definitely see it. And two things about it. One has a Boston history connotation. When the Lowells and the Lawrences and the Jacksons built the mills in Lowell and Lawrence, they were benevolent employees, seemingly like today's Arthur T. And the young girls from the farms flocked to work in these clean factories under good working conditions where they had dormitories and literary societies and all kinds of events for them. It was only 20 or 25 years later when that generation left and the stockholders took over that they started twisting the screws down and the working conditions started to deteriorate. Flip to the 1950s and 60s and 70s in Boston. Mel King has a great line in the book. He said, community activism comes to a group when it has a sense of its own worth and dignity, and it feels deserving of better treatment. And that's what people started to feel like in the late 50s and the 60s and 70s. They said, no, we deserve better treatment. And it's, I think, with the market basket, it's not that the employees love their boss so much. It's that they've been treated well, and they don't want to go back to not being treated well. And so that's the kind of activism you need.
You use the term community activism, quoting Mel King. And if people say, younger people listening, well, I've sort of heard that name. Not only community activists ran in the historic race against Ray Flynn for mayor in 1984.
Beautiful picture of him and Ray Flynn on stage in a debate.
The important thing about that race was the fact that those two made it into the final. Everybody thought that it was going to be one or the other because they were both running on the same platform.
Yeah.
There's a quote saying they were both duking it out for the attention of the people lost in the Kevin White shuffle, the three-decker guy, the little guy. But they both won, and so they both made it into the final, making it a difficult decision for community activists who supported both of them.
You know, Margie and I often bemoan, and it's almost we shouldn't be doing this because it isn't like we're out there doing it, the lack of community activism today. The examples that we often pick are, which are true, is you see tuition raised in Montreal for public college a dollar, and I'm exaggerating, and there are 100,000 people on the street in 10 minutes. It's not just the United States in general, but what you know best, Boston. Is it not fair to say that while there are small pockets of wonderful work being done in some communities, that the level of community activism is not today what you describe glowingly in so many of these stories in the book? Is that a fair statement or no?
Oh, no, I think it's a very fair statement.
Why? Then why are we in that mess of a state?
Part of it is the times have changed. Part of it is that the economy has changed. Part of it is that the people who live in the city have changed. Boston used to be a primarily working-class city. Today, it's a city of poor and the very well-off. People in the working class have a tendency to fight for the things that they have because that's all they have. They fight for their houses, their neighborhoods, their schools. They depend on government, and when government isn't providing the services, they fight for them. Today, you don't have that strong working class, and nobody even wants to talk about the working class. They want to put everybody in the middle. But there was a working class, and there are gradations of economy. And back then, the people in the working class and the lower middle class were the backbone of community activism.
Do you buy it when you hear
been priced out of existence?
One of the few elected officials actually uses the term working class is the guy who was with us a couple of days ago, is the new mayor of Boston. Do you find hope in him for the things that you think are the core of what makes Boston a great city?
Oh, I think he's got tremendous potential to do it. His background, his experience, the fact that he's from where he's from, and his relationships with organized labor, to me, will enable him to champion getting the kind of good jobs at good wages for people who might not have a college degree, at least initially. And those are the kind of jobs that we need in Boston to stabilize the rest of the city.
So, Jim Brable, one last question for me before you go. Should Boston have the Olympics here?
I think that there are so many other things that Boston could be spending its time and attention on that
okay.
are more deserving that the Olympics could go someplace
How do
else.
We find your book, by the way?
The book is published by University of Massachusetts Press. They have a website, umasspress.edu, something like that.
Okay. Well, remember
and it will
this.
Be in the stores.
Okay,
remember
great.
This. The People's History of the New Boston. That is the name of the book. The author is Jim Frable. Congratulations on doing
it's
a
great,
fantastic
Jim.
Job, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam joins us for debate about literary genius John le Carré. Is his hatred of American exceptionalism exceptional writing, or does it come down as a knee-jerk disdain for our sluggish diplomacy? We're also going to talk about snobby Brookline.
Yes,
that's
are.
Up next on 89.7 WGBH.
And before you leave, we just want to say we've gotten a ton of email since it's our first segment today in which we discussed with you an email that I received from a juror in the probation case who really blasted Mayor Walsh and Speaker DeLeo. We'll be advancing the story throughout the afternoon WGBH newscast. Then tune into WGBH Two's Greater Boston Tonight. Our political analyst, David Bernstein, has been following the political fallout from the verdict, and he weighs in on the potential political impact of the jurors' criticism of both Walsh and DeLeo. Again, that's tonight at 7, WGBH 2.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a conversational, fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's a morning news program that is live and in the moment, able to turn on a dime when news develops. We call what we do journalism in the raw. It's live, unedited conversations with newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news. There's kind of more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway. It's The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Coming up at 2 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you. And Newburyport, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newburyport in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org. And Russell, since 1876, where you can find a large selection for gardening, shrubs, fresh flowers, water gardens, birdhouses, and more. Russell's Garden Center, Route 20, Wayland. For more information, you can visit russellsgardencenter.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Gann here with us in Studio 3, as he is every Thursday for Open Mic, is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. And as we do every time he's here, Marjorie and I marvel that his name is Alex Beam, because when Alex writes, Marjorie said this, I think, he's like a Beamer sedan, a hot rod of polite society. What do you think of that, Alex?
That's just, you've really outdone yourself.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you.
What an amazing image.
So, Alex, you do work for the Boston Globe.
Yes,
Boston,
as you do now.
That's right. The Boston Herald, my former employee, had a great piece about this kind of squabble between your legendary sports columnist, Dan Shaughnessy, and John Henry, the owner of the Boston Globe, in which John Henry didn't call Shaughnessy by name, but he referred to a curmudgeon.
A loud curmudgeon.
And we figured it had to be Dan Shaughnessy. But Dan just goes right ahead, new owner or no new owner, just got criticized in the Red Sox ownership left and right.
So we want to know which side you're on.
I'm on the side of big capital, right? Shaughnessy once called me out in the press box by name. He was defending his pal and Marjorie's pal, I might add, Doris Kearns Goodwin. So, like, I don't know. We've had opposition in the past. I'm pretty impressed by Dan's writing generally, and he has been remarkably consistent on the Sox and on the owner. I mean, God bless him. I mean, that takes some inner core. And I generally like his writing on the Sox. I think he's terrific, frankly. And, I mean, he's a real barometer. I mean, they don't get away with much, I fear. Although, God knows, I mean, every time the Herald really has it in for every Globe column, and they're going to have it in for you, too, my friend.
That's right.
He's pointing to Marjorie, not me.
Yeah,
hey, Alex.
I have a few more weeks before that begins.
So let's assume you chose a topic that you had a vague interest in, to quote you from last week, and you decided to write a column. And as you're constructing in your head, you say, you know, I actually should write something about the owner of the Globe. He fits into this column, John Henry. And the thought that you had, I don't know why it would be, might be negative. Would you write it? Because the point of this, Shaughnessy has really savaged the owners of the Reds. Oh, yes, he has. The Red Sox.
Hasn't he been somewhat more moderate since they started signing his paycheck?
I think he has been, whether you agree with him or not, he's been quite courageous. I think he's been quite critical. Not every time. But that's not the issue. The issue for you is nasty.
I mean, he used to basically say that you know, Henry was living on the 40-yard line of the Liverpool pitch and stuff. I mean, he's backed off that a little bit.
But that's not the question. The question is, would you have the – I don't want to say courage, but I will. Would you have the courage, if it fit into the theme of your particular piece, to say something unkind about the man who signs your paycheck?
I've been a bigger sissy over the years than people like Dan Shaw. No, I would be the first to admit it. No, why lie? I was once like, I was once, like, brought into Bill Taylor's office when he owned, like, the Boston Globe.
For what? What's
and
in?
I did a piece on how he stacked the library board. And he's the chairman of the board of the library. And I had this great source who was on the board. And it was just, like, really hilarious, the idea that I could write a column in Bill Taylor's paper about how he had stacked the board of the Boston Public. It was just hilarious.
He called you in because he really liked it?
Yeah. He's just a really polite guy. And he dictated what I call the longest correction in Globe history. I mean, it was funny. He's this genial guy. He just said, you know, don't think for a moment that you're going to be writing this stuff, whether it's true or not. I don't know. Look, I'm an outside contributor now. I'm not that guy. I'm not that gutsy scrapper with any ownership. I mean, not that you asked, but we really lay down for the Times. Okay, big time. And when I say we, I mean everybody.
Times owned the Globe
New
for
York
a while,
Times
if you don't
for
know.
13 years.
Yeah.
And I've been dying to – I don't know why I haven't got around to it, because I have a list of 57 columns. I mean, I literally have a list of 57 columns. And one of them is it okay to make fun of the New York Times now? I mean, I did have a piece spiked about the New York Times. The New York Times was doing these travel pieces out of Phnom Penh and Kabul. It was like 36 hours in Kabul. That was like a travel feature they wrote. And so I just gathered all these and put – and I said, like, this isn't a travel section. This is lunacy. The guy's since been promoted, by the way, the former Times travel editor. And someone who'll go unnamed because she's a nice person, very tall, related to a famous Time media executive, just spiked, you know, said, we're not writing about the Times here, period. So I mean, that's...
So you resigned in protest?
Okay. Exactly.
I guess not.
I love
touché,
you, Alex. You're,
okay, you're an honest man.
Yeah,
now
you're an honest man. Now, let's move on to my second favorite story of the day. I want to talk about this poll.
The survey.
The survey, that's right. That found that, yes, by something called Movoto Real Estate Blog, mm-hmm. that's what the people, that said that Brookline is the third snobbiest small city in all of America. Palo Alto apparently is first, and Bethesda, Maryland is second. And Brookline is right up there in third place.
Isn't it interesting? You've lived in two of those three cities,
I have.
Marjorie.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm
you
sort of snob central.
Snob quotient
but
every
you
time
lived
you
in Palo Alto, you said as well.
I lived in Palo Alto for a year, and mm-hmm. God knows I lived in the district, as we call it. So Bethesda Chevy Chase is hardly terra mm-hmm. incognita to me. It's very disappointing, of course, that Brookline came in only third.
Me too. Well, they did it by median home price, the higher the better, median household income, the higher the better, percentage of people with a college degree and all the private schools per capita, which really surprised me because why would you move to Brookline if you weren't going to go to the public
school?
Well,
also fewest fast food restaurants
fast
per capita.
Foods.
That's
I
a
figured out
important
that,
criterion.
That private school thing is weird, though. It's all about that Lars Anderson area. You know, It's private schools per capita, but it's clearly like private schools on the ground. Like there's Dexter and Park, I think are all hidden.
Oh, yes.
I think they're all hidden over
yes,
there.
But
it doesn't mean Brookline parents send their kids to those schools.
Oh, okay.
That's the way I figured that out.
Okay, thank you very much.
You know, there
much.
Was a story in the Globe a couple of years ago saying how property values were going up and people were moving. I hope I get this 100% right. If not, you can email us.
85% right.
Close enough. To Harvard, Massachusetts, as soon as it was published, the fact was published, that Harvard, the highest scores in the MCAS, the student testing, whatever it's called, MCAS, came out of Harvard, Massachusetts, and people wanted their kids to go to those schools, did terribly well. When I read this thing the other day about Brookline was the third snobbiest town of a certain size in America, originally I said, boy, they must be really upset. But then I say to myself, are they upset, the leaders of Brookline? Or are they thrilled? Because essentially many of these standards that got them to number three are ones that many people find desirable, aren't they? Or are they? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess. I don't think of Brookline as snobby, actually. I think of Brookline as very politically correct. You know, we attempted to outlaw spanking in Brookline. We have already outlawed styrofoam in Brookline. We have outlawed
plastic bags
right, in Brookline. Yeah. So we do all these things.
Yeah, ask us Brookline.
You know, the
Newton,
joke
yeah.
in the schools that if you they have the elections in the grammar schools every year, and if you vote for, you know, George Bush or you vote for a Republican,
you're bullied.
You may be out the door, you know.
That's
so
right.
That's sort of the thing I think of as Brookline. It's very democratic and very politically correct.
Yeah, I don't know where snobby comes in, because people in Brookline aren't necessarily snobby so much as like, what's that word? You just can't take them, right? They're really hard to take.
Hard to take. That's right. And Palo Alto, which used to be sort of this sleepy little town when I was in college there a million years ago, is now like Palo Alto on steroids. I mean, they have got every swank, that little
that
university
really
avenue.
Is that because of the high-tech world, or why is it?
It's all Silicon Valley. I told you the stories about these houses.
Oh, you did,
little
yeah.
tiny houses.
Well,
$10 million.
And Stanford is now, it's like a bank. I mean, it's still a great university, but it's like a bank. I mean, everybody who graduates from there makes $100 million just the day they graduate.
But
me.
Finish your thought about the small exactly. houses, because it's a good point.
Steve Jobs' house was out there, and Mark Zuckerberg's house is up there. And the great story is, I went to a party. I went out for one of my reunions. I went to Stanford. I went to one of my reunions, and I'm in this house, you know, small, modest house, stucco, small amount of land, maybe three bedrooms, something. I said to this woman, what do you think this house is worth? Because of the location. I said, it's got to be probably worth $2 or $3 or $4 million. She said, I think she said 10, or maybe she even said 12. I said, you've got to be kidding. 10 or 12? And she told the great story about how everyone's so loaded out there because of Silicon Valley that the house across the way that had a wraparound porch, that the realtor came over to the people and said, my client really likes your house. I'll pay you. He wants to buy it. And they said, oh no, we really love it here. A few days later, the realtor comes back and says, my client is willing to pay you $20 million.
Wow.
And they said, well, I guess we'll move.
My loyalty to the neighborhood has been somewhat diluted.
Yeah.
Okay, can we leave Brookline for that was Marjorie's favorite story. Here's my favorite story. If people say I'm a fan of Alex Beams, and you say,
well,
what does he do?
Yeah.
Well, Well, maybe, but for those who are, what does he do in his spare time? I can tell you. Just go to the hashtag I'm So Boston. How do you have time to write a column? First of all, tell people what the hashtag I'm So Boston is. And if you haven't been alerted to it, which I wasn't until this morning, again, where Alex is spending a lot of his energy.
You've got to have time to waste, by the way. Great. Of course, by definition, they're listening to your show. So these are people who do have time on their
hands. What is I'm So Boston?
You got to have a Twitter. I'm So Boston is like this hashtag I stumbled across. I actually alerted your producer Sunday night. I was so bemused by it. It's a great expression, and it's a little Twitter hashtag, so people are tweeting out 140 characters, little statements about, like, I'm so Boston, I listen to Boston Public Radio.
They don't say that. I'm going to read you.
Leading the list. What do you mean?
Here are a couple of my favorites, just from scanning the last 24 hours. Here's a guy, Eric Arroyo. Here's what he has to say. I'm so Boston, I still think Bobby Brown can get it together and should be considered a musical legend by everybody. Well, that's a pretty good one, isn't it?
That is a pretty good one.
Here's another one. They're all good, actually. All right. This is from Geek Comedy Night. I am so Boston. This is a great one. I've had the same parking spot for 15 winters, and I don't even drive. That's good?
Excellent.
Thank you. And this is another one, sort of good current events. Hillary Sargent, our friend, former coworker, now the editor of Boston.com. I'm so Boston, I check hashtag Market Basket tweets before I go to bed.
That was a pretty funny one. That got me started on the whole thing, actually. But how come there's not hundreds more? I'm kind of bummed out.
But don't you think, you know what I love about those guys? That's why the hashtags are great. I mean, it does create this, you're going to mock me for this, but I'll say it anyway.
Consider yourself pre-mocked.
There's a communal kind of thing. It's fun, is it not?
It is fun.
I'm going to start doing this after the show. I am.
I'm begging you to.
I'm actually not doing any, but I got to come up with something clever so I'm not embarrassed. But that's a good part
of the
thing.
Well, you can have your staff come up with something clever, the people who do all the Alex Beam.
No, we write all of our own things.
Oh, I can so imagine.
Now, Alex Beam, columnist for the Boston Globe, has a column in the Boston Globe today that gives really an ode to John le Carré, the great, I guess you'd call him a spy thriller writer, and arguing that his books, such as The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, that he's one of the best writers of the entire 20th century, and that John Updike and Saul Bell will be totally forgotten, and John le Carré will be right up there with Graham Greene and Waugh.
Well, to be fair to myself, I stole this argument from this writer named Philip Kerr.
You seem to agree with that, Alex.
Well, hey, don't put me on the spot. No, it was like a set-up argument. I don't know. I just heard that Kerr had this. Yeah, you're right. I mean, but I got him to do all the dirty work. I don't actually buy into columns like that. And I'm far from convinced that John le Carré is the greatest writer of the 20th century. But it was a vaguely credible argument, so I thought I would air it out.
Why not?
Exactly. Plus, I've read a lot of his books, so it sounded like I knew what I was talking about.
So what is the argument? Short version. You don't have to recite your whole column.
Well, I mean, Kerr's argument, I expressed it a little better. I mean, I adopted his argument. But his argument is that the great story of the 20th century is the rivalry between totalitarianism and, you know, democracy, between the Soviet Union, if you will, and the United States. And that this is the story that le Carré tells. I argue, actually, that the great story of the 20th century is the transition from one empire to another, from a rather sophisticated, cultured empire, the colonial empire, to be sure, the British Empire, to the American Empire, which I and le Carré and others, I mean, feel is a little more of a blunt-edged instrument, shall we say, than the British Empire. I knew what Kerr had argued, and I had a weird epiphany. This is like so sick. I had an epiphany looking at an Australian banknote. And there was the
picture. You were in Australia recently.
I was in Australia. Yeah. And there's the picture of Queen Elizabeth. Hmm. And I just asked myself, I said, wait a minute. This is a free country. If 52% of the residents of Australia had a vote or a referendum, they could get the Queen's picture off this banknote, yet they chose to have it. So then I had this cascading series of, I said, like, why? Like, why is this elderly woman who really has no sovereignty or suzerainty over this kind of wonderful dynamic? Why are you laughing?
I'll tell you why I'm laughing.
Why don't you interrupt me with some stupid comment?
Hold on. What was the word after sovereignty? Please?
Suzerainty.
But anyway, suzerainty.
So I was very moved.
Will you please,
I'm not looking it up.
I was just very moved that of its own free will, of its own, you know, a country of 28 million people or something, you know, had a picture of a queen who, in fact, you know, sent all their forebears there in chains as convicts. And, you know, and I mean, Irish and worse, you know, they sent Irish rebels there. And yet, you know, here, so is that, you think someone's going to put George W. Bush's portrait voluntarily on a piece of currency?
It could be a self-portrait. What does that word mean?
I don't know. It's just a stupid word.
Here's the question,
Jim. It means have power over.
Okay.
Jim asked in his introduction is whether his hatred of American exceptionalism is that exceptional writing or knee-jerk disdain for our thuggish diplomacy, as our producer so brilliantly wrote it.
Yes. Well, as I wrote in the piece, I mean, this is another hobby horse of mine. I mean, I. What are the exact words I use? I mean, he came unhinged, you know, during Bush Cheney.
Okay.
I feel a lot of Americans came unhinged. Definitely a lot of Europeans came unhinged. You know, I'm certainly not here to make the powerful argument for how great the Bush Cheney administration was, but I mean, even while it was in existence, I was arguing very. You're still
sorry.
Laughing.
I'll tell you why.
I was arguing very powerfully. You know. We're going to have a chance to vote these people out of office. And eventually, like, you know, we did, shall we say. We did vote them out of office. I mean,
well, America actually, the Constitution voted them out of
precisely.
Office. Precisely. Yes, okay.
But we didn't elect their little minions
afterwards.
Oh, yes, that's
true. Yes.
You know, we changed our country. And I felt that's a great strength that people like Le Carre didn't give us credit for.
Before we leave the topic, I just want to be clear on one thing. So you're arguing that this great transfer, you know, from one empire, the British Empire, to the American Empire, will stand the test of time as seen through John Le Carre, as opposed to, like, the wife swapping of John Updike. You think that may be more important in the long haul? I thought Couples was one of those, you know.
I love Updike.
Even though he is kind of a sexist dog.
He's dead, okay? He cut him some slack.
It's okay. But so you don't think the wife swapping is going to stand up?
I tell you, it's Kerr's argument. I just went along for the ride. Le Carre is a big talent. You know, you could really do worse than reading three or four of his novels.
Now, the reason I was smiling, since Alex exposed me, you're the most dismissive person I've ever met. As you were talking to Marjorie, I'm reading.
Start a new hashtag. I'm so dismissive.
A few weeks ago, this is the top of his piece, I read that Philip Kerr, so-and-so, thought that John Le Carre was the one living English language writer likely to be read and revered by future generations. That's fine. Now, the next two sentences are so Alex Beam, it is painful. Kerr's comment didn't interest me in the least. Reputation speculation just isn't my thing. And then what he proceeds to do for another 700 words is reputation
speculation.
Well, yeah,
pad it out with Kerr's comments and random quotes.
No,
Jesus, I've never written a column?
No. Now, the primary purpose for you being here, as we know, is Alex Beam started, I don't know, 6-7 weeks ago, something that's one of our most popular features on the show.
This would be the
45-second explainer. And today, in 45 seconds, we always turn on the clock and we time them. Alex Beam is going to, what are you explaining again?
The Blackwing 602.
The Blackwing 602. You may start now.
This is a subject I practically own. It's so embarrassing. I've written four columns. I'll try to be really brief. I actually did not bring you one so that we could all examine it for your radio audience. The Blackwing 602, I'm begging people to hit Google, hit my name, do what's necessary. It's the greatest. Now, here there can be no argument. It's the greatest pencil manufactured in the 20th century by Eberhard Faber. It's a pencil so great that Archibald MacLeish wound a huge metaphor about death around it. It's a pencil so great that Roger Rosenblatt, much hailed by PBS, answered an interviewer's question, "I'm so happy you phoned me to talk about the Blackwing 602. It's the only subject that interests me." It's such a great pencil that Stephen Sondheim wrote all his musicals with the 602. That's really all I can give you in 45 seconds.
Wow.
We should do installment two next week because the Blackwing 602 went out of production about 10 or 15 years ago, and now it's back into production.
Back into production.
Well, let's have the sequel next week. We'll do episode two of Blackwing 602.
Okay, but before you go, that's fine. That was actually 60 seconds, but it was quite good.
Thank you.
Is it true that if you go to the Blackwing website, at least at a particular time, what you will find is a column of yours? Is that true?
Well, if you go to pencils.com, in their exhaustive coverage, there's a lot of my columns. But no, the reason this...
Pencils.com.
Hey, shut up,
he's
man.
Huge on pencils.com.
I'm proud of my work.
I know, it's good.
They took
it's
down
fine.
One of my videos. I'm kind of disturbed.
That's too
but,
bad. Good.
No, I
you
was,
had a video about pencils?
Mike Saunders and I at the Globe, we did...
You did a pencil video?
It was terrific. And at the end, he photographed me writing down, "This is my iPhone with a Blackwing 602.
Oh, my God, we got to get that, Jim.
But
we
no, they used me in an ad. That's weird, without my permission.
It's horrible.
The new manufacturer used my name in an ad, and it's like they have a drone outside my window because it says, you can use a Blackwing 602 like Alex Beam does to do the crosswords, but how could they possibly know that I use that pencil to do the crosswords?
So we have Marjorie Egan now, well, soon will be at crux.com, and you can find Alex at pencils.com.
Oh,
that's really.
Well, by the way, yes. We'll see which has more visitors over time.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, my God, the challenge has been issued.
Hey, Alex.
Pencils.com is a very popular website.
So installment number two on next week's Explainer. Alex Beam, thank you so much.
Hey.
Pleasure to see you.
Boston Globe
nice
columnist Alex Beam is with us every Thursday. Thank you very much, Alex, for being here. His new book is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Up next, artificial intelligence. As we get older, can we do the things to sustain the smarts and intelligence we had in our youth? Karen Miller joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, sailing and summer school. Does one help enhance the other? Reporter Rupa Shenoy looks at a study underway tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Hey, political junkies. The Scrum is now a podcast. Our pop-up tussle on politics with reporter Adam Riley, analyst David Bernstein, and me, Peter Katzis. Subscribe today or listen online at WGBHnews.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Northeastern University, where researchers are untangling the complexities of climate change to measure the true cost to the world's cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, committed to providing patients with quality cancer care, innovative services, and personalized treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to getting older, and yes, this is a conversation for everyone because we're all aging as I speak, we haven't seen a pharmaceutical ad for a pill that will help us stay smarter. Big Pharma has figured out remedies for everything from what? Wrinkles, the sexual activity, arthritis, but not for sustaining our native intelligence because researchers are still trying to figure this out. Here with us in Studio 3 for an update on what we do know about staying smart, maybe even getting smarter in some circumstances we age, and what we can do to keep our minds agile is Kara Miller. Kara, of course, is host of the Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
Okay, we're all worried about this. Tell us what we need to do here, please, Kara.
Well, there has been actually a lot of research on different ways to stay smart as you get old. And actually, I want to start with an experiment that a lot of people have heard of, the marshmallow experiment.
Yes.
You know that experiment. So, but if you don't know it, they were done in the 1960s, 1970s, Stanford University. And basically, the researcher had a bunch of young kids come in between 3 and 5 years old and put them in a room with a marshmallow. It actually was other things too, but it became famous for the marshmallow. And basically said, here's a marshmallow. You can eat it right now. Or in 15 minutes, I'll come back. If you haven't touched it, I will give you another one. Well, I mean, the only thing better than a marshmallow is two marshmallows. So most kids were very excited about this idea of, like, if they just waited a few minutes, they would get two, they would get double what they had. Some kids could do it, and some kids could not do it. So it's kind of split into thirds. About a third ate the marshmallow, could not wait. A third had no problem. They didn't eat the marshmallow. They waited the 15 minutes. The researcher came back. They got the second marshmallow. And about a third ate it during that 15 minutes somewhere. They thought they could hold out. They did for a while, but they couldn't really do it. Now, remember, this is 3 to 5 year olds. But what they were showing was this thing called executive function, which is like the ability to plan, the ability to restrain yourself, the ability to sort of mentally rationalize, okay, well, I'm not going to do this now, but that's okay because later somebody's going to come in. There's actually a lot of planning that goes into, I'm not going to do this now, I'm going to do it later, even though it would be pleasurable right now. So one of the questions is, how do you retain your executive function? And one thing that the marshmallow experiment showed was that those kids, when they followed them 20 years later, the kids who had waited, who had been able to wait for that second marshmallow, higher SAT scores, higher incomes, more successful lives. That, in some ways, that was the interesting part of the experiment, to follow up with these kids 20 years later. Because, like, who cares about a 3-year-old, you know, in a room with a marshmallow? What really mattered was how much it indicated success and how much the kids who couldn't wait tended to be more obese, have lower SAT scores, tended not to hold down jobs in the same way. So the question is, how can you increase that executive function? And there's lots of ways, and I know we want to put it out there to people. One really interesting way is learning a second language if you don't already know one.
I mean, we'll prevent you getting dumber as you get older. Yeah. In fact, potentially get you smarter as you get older.
So it turns out, actually, that people who know a second language tend to get Alzheimer's on average 5 years later. And 5 years is not anything to sneeze at. I mean, that is a huge delay.
They've proven a causal connection between your knowledge of an ability to speak a second language and the delay of onset of Alzheimer's?
They've looked at two groups, monolingual people and bilingual people. And people who are bilingual tend to get Alzheimer's an average of 5 years later.
You know, this is a lot of work, let me tell you, learning a second language. Does it count if you learned French or Spanish in school and you've forgotten it all except for, you know, a couple of words and you learn it all over again?
Well, I mean, nobody knows exactly why these people get Alzheimer's later. But I think the thinking is, that in your brain, you have two different sets of everybody knows what a chair is, right?
Right.
And in every language. So the question is, what is the name for that thing that we think of as a chair? Well, the people who know two languages have to keep two sets of definitions and words in their mind at all times, right? They have to be able to toggle back and forth. If I said, say this to me in, you know, a chaise in French, right? Or a chair. And at all times, you have to know those things. So I don't know that forgetting it is going to be helpful enough.
So intellectual dexterity, obviously, is what's going on.
Exactly.
So,
you're exercising your mind.
So we want to know at 877-301-8970, as you're aging, the conventional wisdom, which is very depressing, is you do – I said dumber. That's not fair. But I'll say it again. That you essentially get less smart as you get older. And there appears to be some research that suggests that there are things you can do that not only will stabilize your brain, your intelligence, but actually improve your ability to think and be smart as you age. Our number is 877-301-8970. You know, one of the things that I was stunned by reading for this is that what I thought was a terrific thing, if you want to have time to get smarter, is you engage in routine behavior as your day starts. Mm-hmm. And my thinking was, I was discussing this with Chelsea, our colleague, this morning, is because you basically clear your deck. You don't have to think about what you're going to wear, what you're going to eat, where you're going to go to the gym, or that kind of thing. You can essentially be creative. But the research shows that it's an inhibitor. The more you have routine in the morning, the less all of your creative stuff works and the less your brain grows. What's that about?
Well, there's two problems with morning routines. One is that they tend to be the same every day, right? So what we were just talking about with language is that you're always thinking about, okay, how do I say this? Who am I talking to? You know, what language do I use? So you're always really exercising your brain. So one problem with morning routines is that they stay the same and you don't think about them. The other problem with morning routines is that they tend to sort of kill creativity. So one thing is people tend not to sleep enough. They go very quickly in the morning and they don't have enough time to really reflect on things in any kind of serious way.
Does reflect include, I mean this sincerely, deciding that I'm going to wear that suit or those jeans, is that a decision? Is that I'm serious. Is that a certain level of creativity that's good for you, or does that not qualify?
I mean, I would say that science probably has not broken it down that far, but I would say that higher level thinking, higher level creativity, which we all do. Sometimes we're in the shower and we come up with something brilliant. Like, we should do this at our job, right? You know, I'm sure you've been in the shower and you thought, we should do this as a segment, right? And in some ways, it's probably because you're away from all the distractions, away from all the things that take your energy away. But the way we tend to structure our mornings are we don't get enough sleep, which actually tends to make you smarter. We go very, very quickly in the shower.
Wait, sleep tends to make you
smarter? Yes.
Sleep does
Yes,
make
because
you smart.
We tend to be a sleep-deprived society,
okay,
and
God,
actually
I'm sorry.
Sleeping more makes you smarter. But we also just sort of rush through everything. We go very quickly in our commutes if we possibly can. We tend to be stressed through them, and stress tends to deteriorate brain power. So the way that we structure our mornings tend not to be very helpful.
And what about these brain games everybody promotes all the time?
Right now, there is no science that shows
okay.
that they make you smarter.
Crossword puzzles?
Not any research right now.
What about this one? Now, I thought this was better because this, to me, is less horrific than learning a new language. You know, running a couple of marathons. The aerobic exercise.
That, to me, is more horrific than learning a new language. But it actually turns out that one of the only things that there is scientific evidence for as you get older, there's a few things. We talked about language. One of them is exercise.
Yep.
So there was they did a big study with two groups of people between 60 and 80. And one group did strengthening and toning, and one group did aerobic exercise, and the group that did aerobic exercise did better on cognition tests afterwards.
So exercising, aerobic activity is a good thing.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing because you would think that it would be brain exercise, like you said, like doing crossword puzzles, doing Sudoku. You would think that would be what's really, yeah, really helpful. But in fact, it's exercising your body that is the only thing that's so far being proven to actually increase your brain power as you get older.
So our
numbers. I can see that, though. I can see that because this sounds ridiculous, but I do this sometimes. I used to run a lot when I was younger and when I worked for a magazine. And if I would be stuck, I would go run and it would help me.
Yep.
And you know what I do now? It sounds a little weird. But I like do shoulder stands and let the blood rush to my head.
Not. Whoa.
I do for about 3 or 4 minutes, and it seems
would
like
you
I can
do one right now.
Think better.
No, I'm serious.
When the blood is rushing back down, I can think better.
Do you stand like up against something, or can you just do it like freestanding?
I can't do a handstand or a headstand,
okay,
but I can do a shoulder stand.
Oh, wow.
I'm not that good. Well,
impressed.
That's not that hard. I think you could do a shoulder stand.
I don't know that I can.
You get the blood rushing to your head.
Can I tell you something? I have trouble doing a foot stand. 877-301-8970. So we're talking about essentially that the conventional wisdom that you will get less smart as you get older is not necessarily true. And we want to know from you guys, if any of you have gotten smarter as you've gotten older, I don't mean this facetiously, what have you done? What's been the trick? What's been the thing, the behavior that has gotten you to a better place in your brain? Kara Miller is with us. Let's take a few calls. Rob, you're in Connecticut. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Rob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this. Jim, I think I know what you're going to say, but Marjorie and Kara, I'd like to know your opinion. Do you think that when someone knows a second language that it's necessarily a causal relationship that would lead to a later onset of these diseases like Alzheimer's? Or could it be maybe that someone who knows two languages is just innately more intelligent, more motivated? And the same thing with exercise. People who exercise are more motivated, and that shows through in other parts of their life. So
I think that's really
interested to hear your
thoughts. Chicken or egg kind of
no
deal.
I think it's a really good question. I think with exercise it is possible that the people who, as you say, sort of would be knowledgeable enough to exercise, maybe it is not a causal relationship. Maybe those are simply the people who, you know, for some reason are smarter. I think with language it's less likely, because when you think about people who know two languages, they know them for all different reasons. Sometimes it's because they were really motivated and you know, took classes and learned German at night. But a lot of times it's because they're an immigrant from Vietnam, or, I mean, they don't know two languages because they set out to do that. They may have a third grade education, but, you know, they came here from China when they were in fifth grade, or they came here when they were 25, or from Mexico or wherever. And that's why they know two languages. So I guess I'm less inclined to think that the people who know two languages are just innately smarter people. I mean, I'll tell you one small anecdote. I spent a year in Switzerland when I was a kid, and I was always shocked at how many languages people knew.
Oh.
I mean, you would go on a plane ride, right? And the stewardess on the plane would turn to one person and speak in Italian. There are four languages in Switzerland, four official languages. Turn to one person and speak Italian, turn to one person and speak French, turn to the next person and speak German, turn to the next person and speak English. This is a stewardess on a plane. I mean, this isn't like, you know, she's not a professor. It was shocking.
Do you remember, by the way, that was Rob. Thank you so much for the call. Do you remember when Barack Obama was running for president, I think the first time, and he was roundly criticized because he was talking about how horrible it is that Americans, for the most part, only know one language. He says, we think we're bilingual if we're able to say merci beaucoup. And he was brutalized by opponents for that, but obviously, it helps you in more ways than one. Let's go to Madeline, who's in Roslindale. You're on with Kara Miller, and we're talking about ways to get smarter as you get older. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. First thing I want to say, the best way to get smarter is listen to this radio program.
Oh.
I love it.
Thank you, Madeline. I'm having a crisis in confidence myself.
I'm sure you're not.
Go ahead, Madeline. Thank you very much.
It just happened this morning. I was on my exercise bicycle, and that I have to credit you for, because when you said that people don't buy the books they read or read the books they buy, I started realizing, well, I'm going to read Elizabeth Warren's book while I'm on my bicycle.
Ooh,
this morning,
wow.
I was reading a book, and I've almost finished it, but this morning I was reading a book by Dr. Dharma Zing Khalsa. And this book is called Brain Longevity. And he has actually helped people to halt the progression of Alzheimer's. He has also helped people with memory loss. And his book is about diet, nutritional supplements, meditation, very simple yoga exercises, and as a last resort, pharmaceutical drugs.
And really?
So it's absolutely fascinating.
Boy, and talk about coincidence,
what's
Madeline,
the author's,
timing.
What's the author's last name, Madeline?
Little Heart. Well, any American person who converts to Sikhism, they all seem to have the last name, Khalsa.
Okay. Okay.
I think it's either K-A-L-S-A or there's an H in there somewhere, maybe K-H-A-L-S-A.
Thank you.
And the first part of the name is Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, and the second part is Singh, S-I-N-G-H. So it's Dharma Singh Khalsa. I suspect he's American-born.
Hey, Madeline, thank you, and thank you for the kind thoughts and the book recommendation. We appreciate it.
Well, Madeline also brings up one other thing people talk about. Meditating is supposedly good mm-hmm. for your head, and also learning an instrument. Aren't those
yes.
both?
Yeah, exactly. Both of those things. I mean, the meditation sort of plugs into what we were talking about before with taking some time to really think creative thoughts and make connections. And when you're always being distracted, sort of when you're never bored, this is the flip side of having technology around you all the time. You don't get a chance, your brain doesn't get a chance to be bored. And one of the things Albert Einstein talked about was that boredom actually helped him to come up with what he came up with, because it allowed all these different things that were floating around inside his head to connect with each other in ways that he didn't realize initially that they connected. But you're absolutely right about learning a musical instrument. That, too, like language. And in a way, it is like learning another language, right? People who know music, who can read music, it is like they know some sort of other language. Those people have been shown to be sharper and faster in cognition tests also.
But again, it doesn't, if you go back, like say you're 50 and you want to go back and start playing the flute that you play when you were a kid, it's not going to work as well because you already know how to play the flute.
Well, no, not necessarily. Not if you actually take it up again.
Oh, okay.
And you play it and you really learn, you know, and you actually like learn how to read music and you, yeah, then it really does work. I mean, it's getting good at something. It's getting proficient almost, as I said, in this other language.
Okay.
That really helps you.
By the way, this is the first time, I think, on public radio in America that one of the co-hosts is doing a shoulder stand as she broadcasts. No. Margie, this is really impressive. Can we just change gears for a couple of minutes here before we leave? I don't know if he's getting smarter as he's older, but he's getting more successful. I'm jealous of this, by the way. You talked to the great, weird Al Yankovic, who,
yeah.
by the way, he had his first number one album now in his whole career. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why are you talking to this guy?
Well, so there hasn't been a comedy album at the top of Billboard since 1963 when, I forget his name, but Alan something did like Hello Mother, Hello Father. You
oh,
know
Alan.
Yes, I remember that well.
You know who I'm talking
yes,
about,
I do.
Right?
Sorry.
And that, Weird Al just landed on the top of the Billboard charts.
I
talked to him. I don't know if we've got a clip of one of my favorite songs, one of his new favorite songs. It's called Word Crimes, and it's a takeoff on Alan Thicke's Blurred Lines.
Let's listen a little. Based on having served in the... Whoops.
An espresso, your pot of simple steak, but I don't want your drama. If you really want, leave out that Oxford comma. Just keep in mind that these are you.
By the way, Alan Sherman was the name of the guy who wrote Hello Mother, Hello Fun. Why were you talking to Weird Al? That's great.
So he's doing this sort of breakthrough way of marketing his album, which is 8 videos in 8 days. And one of them was you know, Blurred Lines, which is Alan Thicke, which is this like very sexy song, and he made it into Word Crime. So all it is about grammar and making sure that grammar's right. And Marjorie and I were talking about this the other week, right? We get really upset when people's grammar is wrong. And so I said to Weird Al, like, do you really actually care about grammar? And he said, I really do. It really upsets me. I mean, this whole song is about the difference between like it and it is and less and fewer. So he said to me a few years ago, he went into the supermarket. He had somebody film him, and it said that you have to be in this line if you have 10 items or less. And he crossed it off and put fewer.
That's pretty.
Oh, good
you know,
for
by
him.
The way, one of the things he did that I really, really love, and I think I'm going to get this right. He either wrote a song or did a full album. I think it was a song where every single word in the song was a palindrome. Do you know that? Are you familiar with that?
I don't know that song.
It at least was a whole song, and it was great. He's really pretty.
I think we might go out. I'm not sure if they have it, but there's some great songs, like White Nerdy is a great song about how it's like a takeoff on like gangster rap, and he talks about how he went to MIT and plays Dungeons and Dragons and can say pie to a thousand places. So he's great at sort of making fun of our convention. So I talked to him on Saturday, along with having this discussion about getting smart. Where is he,
by the way? Is he in the West Coast?
He's LA. Yeah. And I think he was shocked by the fact that he got to the top of the Billboard charts by being so unconventional. And he's been somebody who's like at the forefront of nerd culture for 40 years.
Your thesis, or his or somebody's, is that it's the marketing brilliance of this round of, because the
songs
are always similarly
correct. So RCA, which is his label, came to him and said, we are not going to support your music videos when you do this. And normally his music videos are what makes his album.
So he just posted them himself?
He went to like Yahoo. He went to Funny or Die. And he created these music videos himself. And you'll hear a little bit.
So that's Saturday. Those are the two things on Saturday. What's tonight?
Tonight we're talking about the rise and fall and rise again of the Lego Corporation. And then we're talking about how to really get kids into math and science.
Kara, it's great to see you
as always.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, you're going to say something?
Well, I just want to say we've gotten a lot of feedback from the letter we read, an email I received from a juror on the probation trial. It's posted on our website, wgbhnews.org. It will also be followed up on all day long on the station and on WGBH's Two's Greater Boston Tonight at 7 o'clock.
Thank you, guys. First, I'm going to thank Kara for coming in here. She's the host of Innovation Hub, of course, Thursday and Saturday at 10 o'clock in the morning. We're almost out of time.
We are.
So I'm just going to say I am Marjorie Egan.
Well, I'll just say I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in again tomorrow.